is a concept of God for everyone. And we need to basically follow the true religion, which is Islam, obviously, which stops us from all kinds of violences.
And that is why undoubtedly the Islam is the fastest growing religion on the planet of Earth. Thank you very much, Mr. Naqvi, for your participation and answering, you know, you always come here and answer these questions. May Allah give you special rewards, and we truly wish for your prosperity and success in both worlds. In the next episode, we will answer other questions. Till then, take care and may God bless you all.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
European News Bulletin.
Hello and welcome. My name is Amina Taylor, and we begin here in the British capital with our top story. More anger and outrage across the country as the ruling Conservative government ignores calls to scrap its new policing bill. Now, the draft legislation is yet to become law, but the way British police have dealt with protests over the past few weeks, well, it's given everyone a taste of how peaceful protests might be treated once they're awarded their new powers. Chris Bambury, the author and political commentator, is with us. Chris, your thoughts on this rather divisive bill?
We should remember that in the United Kingdom, the right to protest, the right to assembly, was not something given to us. It was something that had to be won, and by defying the law, just the right to vote had to be done that, achieved that way as well. So, I mean, we should be aware as well what they have given us, what the British Labour forced to give us over decades and centuries. They are quite prepared to take away. And this bill goes a long way to take away the right to assembly and the right to protest by putting huge restrictions on that protest. Restrictions on the question of noise, restrictions on static protest, people just standing, having a vigil or whatever. Previously as well, you had to be aware that you were breaking a police injunction to be arrested for that. Now that's no longer the case. If you're unaware of it, you haven't seen the police, we haven't heard an announcement on a noisy demonstration, you could be arrested, that's no defense. And I could continue, but what we're seeing is that this bill is quite a pronounced attack on our right to demonstrate and assemble by a government, right-wing government, where, for instance, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, described the Black Lives Matter protest as dreadful. It's announced the climate protest we've seen in London as well as criminal. So therefore, there are a right-wing agenda that has to appear. And this fits to the pattern across Europe, whether it's in Spain, whether it's in France, where increasingly tight legislation is being introduced. For instance, the gag law in Spain being extended into France, so you can be jailed for insulting a member of the police or the special forces or indeed the royal family. So it reminds us that neoliberalism is not liberal in the sense of the way most people understand it. It's liberal in terms of being free market economics, but it's not liberal in terms of our rights. These are being eroded right across Europe, and this is now happening in Britain with this week's bill.
Now, whilst, Chris, there has been some very vocal protests there, what impact might this have if the bill goes all the way up through the House of Lords?
Well, I think the most important building and the police attack and the vigil for the murdered woman, Sarah Everard, in London, really began a debate about this bill. It brought the bill to people's attention in a way which at the moment it seemed to be slipping past, getting through Parliament. The opposition party, Labour, was going to vote for this, was not going to vote against this bill. The protests have led to a growing awareness among young people, but not just young people, trade unionists, for instance, and others, about the reality of what's at stake here. And there's also other groups affected. The Roma and travelling communities are also being targeted under this legislation. So increasingly, I think there's now a debate about the bill, and Labour have been forced to shift, saying to vote against it, which is something. So I think there's a possibility that we can stop this bill. But that requires the process continuing, the process we've seen. Despite police repression, the sorts of things you saw in the package, and it's fierceness in Bristol, and despite the ridiculous claims of police, which have been forced in class, like police officers being wounded and things like that. So the key thing is the process has got to continue. We've got to keep this debate going, and we've got to try and use extra parliamentary means, because this government has got the majority in the House of Commons to vote this bill through. So it's going to take action on the street, in my opinion, to stop this bill, and increasing the involvement of people, trade unionists, for instance, the Muslim community, who should be worried about this. Other groups need to be getting involved in this, not just the younger people we're seeing demonstrating in Bristol, in Manchester, and other centres, as your package.
All right. Chris Bambury, thank you, as always. Now to some other news there. French senators will meet this week to debate President Emmanuel Macron's controversial Islamist separatism bill, which aims to root out so-called religious extremism in the wake of terror attacks perpetrated by extremists. Critics, however, see the draft bill as a tool that tarnishes the entire Muslim population and panders to growing right-wing populism. Now, last year, President Macron described Islam as a religion in crisis all over the world. French Muslims have already seen laws targeting the hijab, as well as halal poultry farming, and are now braced for more measures targeting their beliefs and way of life. The draft law would broaden the government's powers to close places of worship that have so-called ties to foreign funding and preach extremist ideologies. Various mosques, Islamic charities, and campaign groups fighting Islamophobia have already been shut down. Boris Johnson is a man on the fire for his handling of the COVID crisis and the reaction to the policing bill, but it's a story that broke over the weekend that will be causing concern in Westminster, as Ahmed Caballo fills us in on this one. Ooh, Ahmed.
So many people have suspected this to be true, but now it's been confirmed by the other party, Jennifer Akuri, that she did have an affair, a four-year affair, with Boris Johnson. Now, because of that Tory corruption, Boris is a liar, and Boris affair has been trending on social media. And people are not just concerned with the fact that Boris Johnson lied on camera many times and denied any involvement with this woman in a romantic sense, but more to do with the fact of when he was Mayor of London, she was awarded £126,000 in sponsorships and grants. She was taken on business trips alongside Boris Johnson, paid for by the British taxpayer. And some are concerned that there was a serious conflict of interest regarding Boris Johnson and this woman and the business deals that she was part of. And this is some of the reactions that we started to see on social media. So first tweet by John says, look, the fact that he had an affair while his ex-wife was being treated for cancer shouldn't be any of our business. But once it's established that he sent a Akuri £126,000 of public money as mayor while this affair was going on, that becomes serious. Sue says, how sad that as a nation we aren't surprised a prime minister has lied again and no longer expected to be a resignation issue. These things now are really sad. Boris affair, Boris the liar, hashtag Tory corruption. Now, it's interesting because this story has obviously made its way on some newspapers, but it hasn't got the mainstream coverage that it deserves. And some think that the mainstream media have been covering up for Boris Johnson. And we've actually got a clip from Andrew Marr where he's actually going through the papers on Sunday, and he goes through all the different newspapers with their headlines. But the paper at the bottom, which is the Daily Mirror paper, which talks about the affair and talks about what the four-year kind of arrangement between Boris Johnson and this woman, he completely misses it out and moves on to his guest and completely refuses to talk about it. And it kind of speaks to the fact that when it comes to the Tory party, there seems to be very selective coverage in terms of shielding them from the criticism with regards to extramarital affairs and regards to dodgy business deals, which seem to be associated with the Conservative Party at the moment.
Now, of course, they are the party in the past that were of family values, law and order, you know, some of these bedrock kind of marquee statements. But the rest of your choices here on social media perhaps see through that a little bit.
Yeah, it does. So we've got two more tweets on this. So Kerry says, Boris Johnson cheated with a lover on his sofa in his family home while his wife was away. The PM is the sort of man we all warn our daughters to stay away from. No respect for women, zero family values, moralist and dirty. Yeah, you can see she's not holding back there. And a final tweet from John. He says, the fact that Boris Johnson had a four-year affair and it didn't even make the news on the BBC or ITV main news is shocking. Even Ma covered up the newspaper. And there's one more angle to this story, Amina. Now, last time something like this happened in an imperialist nation, it was the United States, and it was Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And the way, because the mainstream media in the United States made such a big deal out of it, the way that Bill Clinton distracted the public was by bombing a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. So in some ways, people in the global south should feel lucky that the mainstream media isn't making as big a deal about this story as it deserves, because if they were, who knows what the consequences could be.
Well, anything to shift the news agenda, some might argue. Thank you very much, Amit Kabbala. Now we go across to Armenia, where the country's embattled prime minister has confirmed that he will step down from the post in April in order to allow for early parliamentary elections to take place. Nikol Pashinyan has faced weeks of protests calling for his resignation in the wake of Armenia's defeat in last year's conflict with Azerbaijan. Pashinyan will step down in April but will remain in office as the interim prime minister until the June 20th elections take place. The country has been facing months of anti-government protest after Pashinyan signed a Russian brokered peace deal ceding swathes of land to neighboring Azerbaijan following the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. To Slovakia now, where the country's prime minister has stated that he will step down amidst the country's political crisis, which was triggered by him unilaterally choosing to buy the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Igor Matovic said he will switch places with the country's current finance minister, Eduard Heger, who will become the new prime minister. Slovakia became the second European Union country after Hungary to register Sputnik amidst shortages of the Pfizer, Moderna and AstraZeneca jabs approved by Brussels. The Russian vaccine, which according to Moscow trials boosts an efficacy rate of 91%, is still awaiting the green light by the bloc's regulator, the European Medicines Agency. The reactions to a British teacher who was suspended for showing a class of students an offensive cartoon of Prophet Muhammad have continued to pour in. In Britain, an online petition demanding the complete sacking of the Batley Grammar School teacher has surpassed 25,000 signatures and continues to grow. Whilst in Egypt, Al-Azhar, the Sunni Muslim world's foremost religious institution, has strongly denounced the display of offensive cartoons, which had been earlier republished by the disgraced French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. Human rights organizations say Persian Gulf states are spending billions of dollars on sports events to cover up their abysmal human rights record. The Formula One Grand Prix, hosted by Bahrain over the weekend, won such event. Formula One has now signed a $1 million contract with Saudi Arabia as well, notorious for human rights abuses and leading the war on Yemen. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in the next report.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
"I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave."
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yousaf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yousaf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison. Ahead of this year's event, 61 British MPs urged Formula One's new CEO to establish an independent inquiry into abuses linked to the Bahrain Grand Prix and to meet with victims and rights groups before the race to secure their compensation. Needless to say, that didn't happen.
No one wants to see their favorite sport being hijacked or used as a smokescreen for dark and sinister human rights abuses to continue unchecked. And fans have accused Lewis Hamilton now of politicising the sport because of his solidarity with the Black Lives Movement and his inquiries on the ongoing situation in Bahrain. But people in such highly visible international audiences are, of course, expected to be outspoken when they are benefiting exponentially from the public profile that they have. And they know that their silence will be seen as complicity.
Now Formula One has signed a 10-year, $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which, according to human rights organization Grant Liberty, has spent at least $1.5 billion on sports washing, hosting Formula E, the Dakar Rally, wrestling, tennis, the Spanish and Italian Super Cups, and European Tour Golf over the last 2 years. Amnesty International says, like all of them, Formula One will be used to sportswash the kingdom's, quote, appalling human rights record, let alone the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people and pushed a nation to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Before we update you with a particular angle on the ensuing chaos in the Suez Canal, we've got Robert Inlakesh for a story that has some real lasting global implications here. We're talking another social media giant and another case, some say, of censorship. Robert.
Well, Venezuela has come out and called Facebook's actions, that's banning for 30 days the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, for speaking on what he has called as a potential cure or something that can remedy the coronavirus as digital totalitarianism. And a lot of people have came out criticizing this move as well, saying that the banning of Donald Trump set a precedent. Now they're going after other leaders and these big social media giants feel that they can act with impunity, banning whatever opinions they want. We've seen this also affect other agencies, Press TV, of course, being one of them, having their pages taken down. In this case, we are looking at something specific to the coronavirus. However, a lot of people have been speculating, why now is it that they decide to take down Nicolas Maduro for talking about something which has been a product which has been developed inside of Venezuela and not, to anyone's knowledge, been tested inside of the West as to its efficacy rating or how well it works. And it's just so easy for them to go after a world leader and take that world leader's platform away from them online so that they cannot communicate with others. And on top of that as well, we see that media organizations, political figures, specifically we see the targeting of activists, pro-Palestine activists as well, having their pages censored. So there is absolutely no reach, even if their page remains up. This is something that most people who post about political topics, anything that has to do with politics, which goes against the mainstream establishment, will have ran into and endured at some point.
All right, the reaction to this, I think, has been quite scathing, as you'd appreciate.
The first one we have here commenting on this is a account on Twitter called Pablo. They go by, they say, what a shame. The idea is always to give a bad image about Latin America and the rest of the world. Cuba has created its own vaccine against COVID-19. China has created 17 vaccines against COVID-19, and Russia had created 3. Just making a point there that, of course, other countries are capable of developing vaccines, and we don't really hear much coverage in a positive light of them. We've got another one here as well from Sayed Mohamed Marandi, who says, Facebook has permanently removed Press TV's page with 4 million followers. Why are they so afraid? They are already they've already removed hundreds of thousands of Iranian, Iraqi, Lebanese, Syrian, Yemeni, Afghani accounts, mine included. What are they so afraid of?
That is a valid question, Robert. Now, something else that's dominated the back and front pages here has been the ongoing situation in the Suez Canal with the blocked tanker. There has been some development, but the angle you are going for is a slightly more politicized one. Please bring me up to speed.
The story is an interesting one. Of course, it's hit headlines all over the world. This is something really of historic nature, this blockage that we've seen by a ship the size of the Empire State Building. They've said this has been managed to be wedged out. There's a large backlog behind the ship, and so this will take until the end of the week, we're hearing, to clear everything going through. But one interesting aspect I feel like has been left out of the conversation, or at least been wedged in there subtly, if anything, is the fact that this blockage here is going to be used and is being used already to promote alternative trade routes. We know that Egypt has signed on to the One Belt, One Road initiative with China. China's utilizing the Suez Canal. And now, because of the fact that large ships like this, these sort of super tankers as well, which, of course, much of the world's trade is done with, are having to pass through the Suez, and it can't quite take them, the new trade route, which is being presented as a result of the normalization deal between Israel and United Arab Emirates, is going to be advertised off of the back of this. And that could take away 16% of all traffic going through the Suez Canal, possibly more. This is a great sales pitch, and this is despite the fact that Sisi, Egyptian president, had expanded the Suez Canal back in 2015. So,
all right, give me your tweet of choice, Robert.
So we're going to go to the tweet we pulled up here from Syrian Girl. She says, days before the Evergreen got lodged in the Suez Canal, Israel was pushing its alternative canal plan in the media, and now they are continuing to do so. This is JSLS, that's the Jewish state in the Levant. That's what she's saying it stands for, a plan to get crowdfunding or something, hashtag Suez blocked.
All right, we leave it there. Interesting to ponder that one. And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Please stay there. Until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an...
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of...
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
روز قیامت باید جوابش بدن.
Allah and resurrection are two concepts that come together everywhere. On the day of resurrection, I have to answer the questions of Allah about my deeds in this world. If you say something or if you hear something, you are asked about all of them on the day of resurrection. Thus, mere thinking about the concept of the day of resurrection controls my evil deeds and carnal desires. The day of resurrection is like a source of inspiration for people, because thinking about it makes people automatically to do good things in this world. We humans are not like animals. We have some duties to do, and the day of resurrection makes us think about the effects of our deeds. Ma'ad, or resurrection, has been the topic of some of the major books in the world. Allama Tabatabai is one of the Muslim scholars who authored a book on this subject. Zubdatul Ma'arif is the title of a book compiled by Ali Akbar Isfahani, which has some important points about Ma'ad. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Prosecutors accuse former police officer Derek Chauvin of killing a defenseless George Floyd by grinding and crushing him until the very breath, the very life was squeezed out of him at the opening on Monday, 29th of March, of a murder trial regarded by millions of people as a litmus test for U.S. police accountability. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Chris McGreal and Amudalat Ajasa. The piece is titled, Prosecutors Accuse Derek Chauvin of Killing George Floyd as Trial Starts. Stay with us for more of Chris McGreal and Amudalat Ajasa's article. Prosecutors accuse former police officer Derek Chauvin of killing a defenseless George Floyd by grinding and crushing him until the very breath, the very life was squeezed out of him at the opening on Monday, 29th of March, of a murder trial regarded by millions of people as a litmus test of U.S. police accountability. The prosecutor, Jerry Blackwell, told the jury that the death of George Floyd last May, which reignited the Black Lives Matter movement and set off months of protests across America and around the world, was caused by Derek Chauvin keeping his knee on the neck of the dying man for more than 9 minutes, even after he stopped breathing. What Mr. Chauvin was doing, he was doing deliberately, Jerry Blackwell said as he outlined his case to the jury in the courtroom in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the city where George Floyd was killed. The prosecutor said Derek Chauvin used excessive and unreasonable force without regard for George Floyd's life. Blackwell said it was an assault that led to the victim's death. Derek Chauvin, a 45-year-old, has denied charges of second and third degree murder and manslaughter over the death of the 46-year-old African-American man who was detained on suspicion of trying to buy cigarettes with a counterfeit $20 bill last May. The former police officer, who was fired, faces up to 40 years in prison if convicted of the most serious charges. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, told the jury in his opening statement that the evidence will show that George Floyd was under the influence of drugs and that the force used against him was reasonable because of his behavior. Outside the fortified courthouse in Minneapolis, the Floyd family lawyer, Benjamin Crump, declared the trial a test of American justice system and said that the world is watching. Today starts a landmark trial that would be a referendum on how far America has come in its quest for equality and justice for all, he said. A group of protesters held signs that read, "Minneapolis will never forget George Floyd," and "Mr. George Floyd is not on trial, Derek Chauvin is." Jerry Blackwell showed the jury a 9-minute and 29-second video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck, the footage that had shocked millions of Americans last year and prompted the huge racial justice protests that swept the United States and beyond. "You can believe your eyes that it was homicide. It was murder," he told the jury, some of whom had not seen the video before. In the recording, George Floyd can be heard saying 20 times that he could not breathe and 10 times that he was dying. He repeatedly called out for his dead mother. Jerry Blackwell said that the dying man can also be heard to say, "Tell my kids I love them and I'll probably die this way. I'm through. They're going to kill me." Blackwell said that George Floyd was no longer breathing for the last minute that Derek Chauvin was kneeling on his neck. The prosecutor said that the police officer not only failed to fulfill his legal duty to help George Floyd, but stopped anyone else from assisting him, including a firefighter trained in first aid. Blackwell said that even when Derek Chauvin was told by a paramedic that George Floyd no longer had a pulse, the police officer kept his knee in place. "You'll see that he does not let up. He does not get up. Even when Mr. Floyd does not even have a pulse, it continues on," he said. He said the jury will hear testimony from a police officer who arrived on the scene while George Floyd was held down, who will say that at that point there was no need for the force used by Derek Chauvin. The prosecutor also said that the Minneapolis police chief, Medaria Arredondo, who fired Derek Chauvin shortly over George Floyd's death, will testify that the former police officer's conduct was not consistent with Minneapolis Police Department training or protocol. "He will tell you it's excessive force," Blackwell said. The prosecutor said that George Floyd's arrest was unnecessary in the first place, as passing a counterfeit bill, even if intentional, is a misdemeanor for which the police could have written a ticket. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, said in his opening statement that he will show that his client's behavior was reasonable under the circumstances because George Floyd was under the influence of drugs at the time of his arrest. He said witnesses testified that George Floyd had taken opioid pills shortly before he was detained and that at times he passed out. The evidence will show that when confronted by police, Mr. Floyd put drugs in his mouth in order to conceal them from police, he said. Eric Nelson said that George Floyd took a speedball of opioids and methamphetamine, and that as a result he was struggling violently against arrest, which necessitated use of force. Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over his 19-year career, he said. The outcome of the trial may well center on the cause of death. Eric Nelson said medical evidence will show the presence of drugs as well as other medical issues, including coronary heart disease and an enlarged heart, were the cause of death. He said there is no medical evidence of asphyxiation. The official autopsy and an independent autopsy at the time concluded that the main cause of death was homicide. Jerry Blackwell said this was not a heart attack. The first prosecution witness was a 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry, who told a police supervisor she was concerned at seeing the police officers sat on this man in a live feed from a street camera. Blackwell said of Jenna Scurry's testimony that she called the police on the police. Later in the afternoon, prosecution witness Donald Williams, a 33-year-old, told how he watched George Floyd slowly fade away from close by, even as bystanders implored and berated the police officer holding him. Donald Williams told the court that he could hear and see George Floyd in distress, and his martial arts experience indicated to him that Derek Chauvin was choking out George Floyd as he kneeled on his neck. The jury and the public watching in court or around the world by live stream was shown some devastating clips of Derek Chauvin allegedly shimmying in what Williams said was a martial arts move, altering his position very slightly so that it put more pressure on, as a fighter does when they have someone in a hold. Williams heard George Floyd talking about how much pain he was in, his distress as he said he couldn't breathe, apologized to the police officers and begged for his life. The more that the knee was on his neck and the shimmying going on, the more you see him, Floyd slowly fading away. His eyes rolled to the back of his head, Williams said. He described Floyd dying like a fish in a bag. Williams described the knee position as a dangerous blood choke intended to cut Floyd's airway. Williams has previously been heard but unseen shouting angrily at the police officer from the sidewalk, calling Derek Chauvin a bum and accusing him of enjoying what he was doing as George Floyd suffers and begs. The trial continues.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We've mentioned this topic before, but I'd need to mention again because it's relevant to today's session, and that is, what are our primary needs as human beings? Things that will keep us alive, of course. Those are the primary needs. Without them, we will cease to exist. And that is pretty much, number one, our food. Number two, our water, eating and drinking. And number three would be reproduction. And, of course, reproduction for the sake of bringing about a next generation, not for the sake of him or her their life being dependent on reproduction, no. But for the sake of having a next generation, reproduction is also a primary need. And there are secondary needs. These secondary needs are things that you need to have, but if you don't have them, or if you don't have them in certain ways, then it won't be the end of your life, literally saying. And then, of course, there are the pseudo needs, which are things that you think you need, but in reality, you don't. When it comes to something like a necessary need, a primary need that we would also need to have as human beings, is the need for shelter. And shelter is not something that we should take lightly, because it brings about a lot of important aspects of our lives. You know, it would keep us away from harm, it would keep us healthy, it would give us the safety and security that we need, the privacy that we need as well, and everything else that comes along with shelter. And that's why in chapter 9 we're talking about accommodation, we're talking about shelter, we're talking about having a home, a house for one to live in, and everything else that comes along with that as far as your facilities for living a comfortable life is concerned. Now, we've already mentioned that comfortable life in the Islamic understanding is not a life of luxury. So we need to make that very, very clear again. When we're talking about comfort, we're not talking about luxury. We're talking about you being able to fulfill your basic kind of daily routine within the comfort of your own privacy, without having to feel humiliated or degraded by, you know, extending your hand to other people or doing something that you wouldn't be happy to do in normal circumstances.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
When we are talking about, even in the area, in this area of accommodation and living, it also means that one should take into consideration this level of comfort for the sake of a greater good, for the sake of you being able to fulfill your requirements and your duties towards your spouse, towards your children, towards your family members, and maybe even towards other people around you as well. You know, we have a hadith that says that, you know, a wonderful house, you know, just in rephrasing, a wonderful house is a house in which an orphan is being honored and taken care of. And a wretched house is a house in which an orphan is being mistreated. Anyway, the word that is usually used when it does come to the topic of accommodation is maskan. And maskan comes from the root Arabic root word sakana. And sakana is also the root word for sakina, which is tranquility. So that level of sukoon, that level of sakina, that level of harmony and inner peace and tranquility comes when a person is in their own home. And that's exactly why al-maskan pretty much means a place of rest, a place of tranquility, a place where you will feel harmonious. Now, when we look at the ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that speak about this level of, if we could say, facilitating your needs and your requirements and giving you that level of tranquility and peace that you have, whether this be mentioned in the Holy Quran, verses in the Quran about it, or riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, it all comes down to that level of comfort that a person needs to have, but bearing in mind, not talking about extravagance, not talking about luxury. You know, you want to live in a comfortable place, doesn't necessarily need to have a jacuzzi and a sauna and a 15-meter swimming pool and this and that. Doesn't need to have these things. That's not what will bring you comfort, I should say. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاه والسلام على سيدنا محمد واله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.